the headlines. Kiev and Moscow are set to return to the negotiating table to discuss peace, with Russia seeing some hope for reaching a compromise. Concerns are on the rise over the financial ramifications resulting from sanctions on Russia. Just ahead, report from Brussels. British Iranian national Nazanin Zahari Radcliffe is leaving Tehran for the UK after serving a 6-year jail term on charges of espionage. Hello and welcome, everybody. It's day 21 of the Russian military action in Ukraine, and its forces are stepping up their attacks on the capital, Kiev. Early on Wednesday, several explosions were heard in the city's west, with thick clouds of smoke billowing into the sky. Several residential buildings were damaged in an overnight bombardment. 2 people were wounded. On Tuesday, at least 4 people were killed in a Russian strike on several buildings in the city. A curfew is now in place in Kiev and is expected to last till Thursday. There are fears that a full-scale assault could come at any moment. Meantime, battles rage on in Mariupol, Kharkiv, and Mykolaiv. About 700 people have been reportedly killed in the conflict. Ukraine says more than 100 of them were children. Russia says an agreement is within reach on some formulations for a possible truce deal, raising hopes of an end to its ongoing conflict with Ukraine. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Kiev's neutral status and security guarantees are being discussed. He says the talks are not easy, but there is some hope of reaching a compromise. The Russian diplomat also pointed to Washington's decisive role in defining Ukraine's position, saying there's no sign of the U.S. being interested in resolving the conflict. Meanwhile, Ukraine, too, is sounding an optimistic note about the ongoing talks.
Everyone should work, including our representatives, our delegation for negotiations with the Russian Federation. It is difficult but important, as any war ends with an agreement. The meetings continue, and I'm informed that the positions during the negotiations already sound more realistic. But time is still needed for the decisions to be in the interests of Ukraine.
Earlier on Tuesday, an advisor to Zelensky said the negotiation process was very difficult and slow, but a compromise was within reach. He said, with fundamental contradictions remaining between Kiev and Moscow, the discussions will continue Wednesday. In recent days, officials from both sides have expressed hope that a peace agreement can be reached over the next few weeks. And the Ukraine crisis has dragged on for 21 days, and forecasts say the war is going to inflict severe economic hardship on people there.
We are presenting a number of scenarios, because if the conflict is a protracted one, if it were to continue, we are going to see poverty rates escalate very significantly.
According to the UN Development Program, 90% of Ukrainians could plunge into poverty if the war lingers over the next year. The organization is planning to provide cash transfers to Ukrainians so they can afford basic needs such as food. Otherwise, people will continue to flee Ukraine and the economy will probably collapse. The UNDP says an emergency cash transfer operation to Ukraine will cost $250 million per month. This would only partially cover the income losses of 2.6 million people who are expected to fall into poverty. Also, the International Monetary Fund has predicted that Ukraine's economy will experience a 10% contraction next year. We're going to go back to the issue of Ukrainian refugees, which we're seeing an influx mostly in neighboring Poland. Our correspondent Robert Carter is joining us now from Warsaw to bring us up to speed on the issue of the Ukrainian refugees as the Russian military operation expands in Ukraine. Robert, what details do you have to share with us?
Thank you. Well, obviously the situation here is going from bad to worse, because as Poland has put up a very brave humanitarian effort, of course, it's been some time now and more refugees are pouring into the country every single day, thousands every single day. Some 1.7 million refugees are currently here in Poland. So it's a very difficult situation. And how long can Poland maintain this effort with the little support it's been getting from its allies in the West, is the main question. But what I want to say very quickly is that obviously in the West, the mainstream narrative now is that the blame should fall on Russia specifically. But I have something to say. These people, the people right behind me, none of them should be here. None of them should be here. Less than, what, a couple of weeks ago, these people would have been at home in their home country living normal everyday lives. But they're here. They're queuing up. They're begging for free handouts, for free food, for nappies for their children so that they can keep their children clean. These people shouldn't be here. Now, Ukraine, of course, I won't go into the history. It's a very complex, nuanced situation. But Ukraine, for many decades now, has been fed a lot of stories, a lot of tall tales from its so-called allies in the West. The European Union has been flirting with membership for many years. They never delivered it. NATO, again, has been flirting with membership for Ukraine, has never delivered it. Even now that the military operation is underway and the Ukrainians are literally calling to their so-called allies, will you come and do this? Will you come and do that? Will you let us become members of NATO, the European Union? They've been rejected point blank. So the fact is that the West has dragged Ukraine away from its historical neutral position on Russia's border, and they've pushed it towards becoming more militaristic, more hostile, more pro-West. And this, of course, you could argue, some may argue, has helped create this dire catastrophe that you see happening literally right behind me. These people didn't ask to be put in this situation. Now they have to pick up the pieces. Ukrainians have become, I dare say, cannon fodder for a failed Western policy. And of course, I'm giving a bit of my opinion here, I'm sorry to say, if I dare say so, but look behind me. I've been here for a week now. Far too many innocent people are suffering, and it's been allowed to go on. And the reaction from the West has been poor and slow. And we're talking about women and children, some younger than my one-year-old daughter, wrapped in blankets, without food, without somewhere safe and warm to stay. It's truly heartbreaking.
Thanks a lot, Robert Carter, joining us from Warsaw. European Union finance ministers warned sanctions being imposed on Russia over the conflict in Ukraine will severely damage the EU's economy for an unknown period of time. Fuel and food prices are set to rise even more sharply than they already have. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
As the cost of living in the EU goes through the roof, union members held a demonstration outside a meeting of EU finance ministers in Brussels on Tuesday. They want the bloc's leaders to provide more support for EU citizens who are being hit hard by the financial ramifications resulting from the conflict in Ukraine.
And it's also why we need to say that we need to stop this war, because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation, and now we have to say stop. Stop this war and stop Putin in Ukraine.
Finance ministers have signed off on the fourth package of sanctions against Russia. 600 individuals have been targeted, and Russian exports too. However, there is a very negative boomerang effect for the EU itself.
We'll see overall higher inflation, pressure on energy and food prices, and market volatility. Rising energy and commodity prices, disruptions of supply chains, it all will have negative knock-off effect on consumer prices and on investment.
Russia, which is now the most sanctioned country in the world, has been removed from the so-called Most Favoured Nation clause relating to the World Trade Organization.
This major decision entitles the EU to increase customs duties at any moment on Russian products. As regards sanctions, all options remain on the table.
Finance ministers say 200 billion euro worth of loans are available to EU nations most impacted by the Ukrainian refugee crisis. Critics say if Western leaders had have shown more skill and compromise when listening to Russia's security concerns, the misery now being piled on Ukrainian citizens and the financial hardship being placed on EU citizens could have been avoided. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Nazanin Zahari Ratcliffe, a British-Iranian woman who served a six-year term in Iran for her involvement in espionage activities, is leaving the country for the UK. Zahari's British passport was handed to her in recent days. She was arrested in 2016 by Iran's intelligence authorities and subsequently prosecuted and jailed for involvement in acts of espionage. Another British-Iranian prisoner, Anousheh Ashoori, has also been released and is accompanying her. Ashoori was convicted of spying for Israel's intelligence service and acquiring illegitimate wealth. Happening at the same time, London has settled a long overdue debt of $530 million to Tehran. Britain owed the amount to the Islamic Republic for hundreds of military vehicles that the former Pahlavi regime had paid for up front but were never delivered. Britain had been using different pretexts, including the sanctions against Iran, to delay a debt settlement for more than four decades. Moving on, Iran says a good, strong, and stable deal can be finalized with support from all negotiating parties in the Vienna talks if the United States adopts a realistic approach. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, who was speaking to his Chinese counterpart over the phone, hailed Beijing's constructive role in the Vienna negotiations that are focused on removing Iran's sanctions. He also noted that boosting relations with China is a top priority for President Ibrahim Raisi's administration. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi also reiterated Beijing's support for finalizing the Vienna talks. The conversation came a day after Amir Abdullahian paid a visit to Moscow, where he gained Russia's support for the revival of the Iran agreement.
Tehran expects a good agreement to be reached in the near future in its talks on the revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. This was made by Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian at a press conference following talks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Moscow. Amir Abdullahian said the delay in the negotiations could lead to the creation of good ground for resolving the remaining issues. He also said that Russia has not created any obstacles in the negotiations on the JCPOA revival, and that the Vienna talks are in no way connected with the conflict in Ukraine.
Russia does not create any obstacles to reaching agreements. There is no connection between the developments in Ukraine and the Vienna talks. And until the end of the negotiations and the achievement of a good, powerful and lasting agreement, Russia will be close to Iran and will support Iran to achieve this agreement.
Meanwhile, Sergei Lavrov said his country has received written guarantees from the United States that Western sanctions on Russia over Ukraine will not affect cooperation with Iran within the framework of the JCPOA.
We received written guarantees. They are included in the text of the agreement itself on the resumption of the JCPOA on the Iranian nuclear program. These texts provide reliable protection for all the projects and areas of activity envisaged by the JCPOA, including the direct involvement of our companies, specialists, including their cooperation on such a flagship project of our cooperation as the Bushehr nuclear power plant, in the context of all existing plans in this regard.
Lavrov also rejected claims that Russia has created an obstacle to negotiations in the Austrian capital, backing the quick revival of the 2015 agreement.
There have been no exorbitant demands from our side, and there are none. All our rights within the framework of cooperation with Iran on the projects that the JCPOA provides for are reliably protected. I have heard how the Americans are trying to accuse us every day that we are slowing down this agreement. That's a lie. The agreement has not yet been finally approved in some capitals, and the Russian capital, Moscow, is not among them.
Amir Abdullahian and Lavrov also discussed other issues, including the Ukrainian conflict and regional issues such as developments in Afghanistan, Syria, and Yemen.
The foreign ministers, along with political and diplomatic issues, discussed economic affairs in order to neutralize the negative impacts and consequences of the U.S. and Western anti-Moscow sanctions through closer cooperation and rapprochement. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Saudi Arabia has executed a record 81 people in a single day, drawing widespread condemnation. The U.N. says that implementing death sentences in the absence of fair trials may amount to a war crime, but why would Saudi Arabia decide to execute so many people in one day, especially before Islam's holy month of Ramadan, knowing the controversy and uproar it would cause?
On Sunday, Saudi Arabia executed 81 men over terrorism-related charges. It's the largest mass execution the country has so far carried out on record. The figure exceeded the country's total death sentences it handed down last year. Of the 81 people, 73 were Saudi citizens, 7 were Yemeni, and 1 was a Syrian national. More than half of those executed were Shia Muslims, including teenagers from the Recife Qatif region. The convicts also included members of Yemen's Ansarullah movement. They were accused of having links to Daesh and Al-Qaeda terror groups, but documents verifying the charges are yet to be made public.
Look, in the past, it's been quite clear over a number of years that the kingdom is in no way averse to executing people without what under Sharia would count as due process, and in particular targeting individuals because of the beliefs they hold.
The announcement drew widespread condemnation from around the world. Rights activists say the prisoners were put to death for nonviolent acts. Advocates are also questioning the validity of the court proceedings and treatment of the inmates. They say some of the trials were held in secret and that the prisoners had been tortured. Saudi Arabia's last mass execution came on January 2, 2016, when the kingdom killed 47 prisoners, including prominent Shia cleric Sheikh Nimr Baghir al-Nimr. They, too, were given capital punishment without fair trials. The cleric's only crime was to call for democracy and rally anti-regime protests.
The United Nations is calling for more than $4 billion in aid for Yemen as the humanitarian situation there deteriorates following 7 years of a Saudi-led war and blockade. Head of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Martin Griffiths, has made the call. He says Yemen's economy lies in ruins and basic services are collapsing. According to Griffiths, there is a need to plug a huge gap in funding for the life-saving response. Saudi Arabia started the war in March 2015, targeting Yemen's most vital infrastructure. Yemen has also been under a tight blockade since then. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. Millions are facing starvation, and millions more have been displaced. The U.S. dollar's dominance of the global oil market is at stake amid reports of Saudi Arabia being in talks with China to price some of its oil sales in yuan rather than dollars. As reported by the Wall Street Journal, Riyadh and Beijing have been in discussions about yuan-based oil contracts for 6 years. China is Saudi Arabia's largest trade partner. It purchases a quarter of Saudi oil exports. Those sales, if priced in yuan, would raise the value of the Chinese currency. U.S. media reported in recent days that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had snubbed U.S. President Joe Biden and refused to talk to him over the phone last month. The U.S. has been looking to convince Persian Gulf Arab states to increase their oil production as a substitute for Russian energy supplies. But Riyadh is reportedly concerned over Washington's commitment to its security, especially after the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the televised speech delivered on March 1st, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Mab'ath. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure progeny, especially the one remaining with God on earth. I congratulate the entire great Islamic Ummah, the dear Iranian nation, and all liberated individuals in the world on the occasion of the auspicious and grand Eid al-Mab'ath. Ba'tha is the day when the greatest divine gift was bestowed on the Holy Prophet of Islam. God's greatest servant in Mab'ath Eve prayer, Ba'tha has been described as the great light. Of course, the Holy Prophet's Ba'tha is a gift to all of humanity as well. If we only consider two values from among all Islamic values, the expansion of rationality and the cultivation of morality, of course, Islamic values are vast in scope, but those two values are outstanding. And if we wish to see what Islam has mentioned about these two values, we will confirm that Islam has given the best gift and the means for bliss to humanity.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The fact that Islam invites people to the expansion of rationality is very important. There are tens of, and perhaps about 100, ayahs and verses in which God, the Exalted, invites people to thinking and deliberating with terminologies such as thinking, learning, understanding, and the like. As for the expansion and cultivation of morality, it would be enough to say that Islam has placed morality at the top of the goals of Ba'tha. In several ayahs of verses in the Holy Quran, morality has been highlighted, such as in this verse, "It is He who has sent amongst the unlettered an apostle from among themselves to recite them His signs, to purify them. Chapter 62, verse 2. There are other ayahs and verses in the Holy Quran in which morality has been mentioned as the goal of Ba'tha. Morality is at the top of all goals. Therefore, Islam has given these two lofty values to humanity and has invited believers and all human beings to think and to cultivate morality. This is the biggest gift that Islam could have given to humanity.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In the early hours of Sunday, massive explosions rocked the capital of Iraq's northern Kurdistan region, Erbil. A dozen ballistic missiles hit secret Mossad bases there, reportedly leaving several Israeli operatives dead. Then a statement came from Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. The force said it had fired powerful and precision strike missiles targeting a strategic center for conspiracy and evil acts of the Zionists. The IRGC said the attack follows Israel's recent crimes and promised that those atrocities would not go unanswered. The IRGC warned that further Israeli acts of aggression would receive a tough, decisive, and destructive response. It underlined that the security of Iranian nationals was the red line of the country's armed forces. Israel has long been blamed for a wide range of anti-Iran measures, including acts of sabotage against its nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iranian scientists. Former Israeli officials have also confirmed the regime's role in the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq in 2020. And just last week, two IRGC officers were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Syrian capital Damascus. At the time, the IRGC vowed that Israel would pay for the crime. In 2018, Israel killed a number of Iranians during an attack on an airbase near the city of Homs in western Syria. There have been a number of Iranian military advisors in Syria, as requested by the Damascus government. Iran later retaliated with a barrage of missiles targeting Israeli military positions in the occupied Golan Heights. The missile strike on Erbil could be seen in the same light. Iraq's Kurdistan regional government officials have denied the presence of Israeli bases in Erbil, but the two sides enjoy friendly ties. Back in 2014, Israel bought Kurdish oil despite opposition from the central Iraqi government and threats to take legal action. 3 years later, Israel endorsed an independence referendum carried out in the Kurdistan region. And last year, Erbil hosted a conference on normalization of ties between Iraq and Israel, prompting public outcry. The Kurdish regional government said it was not aware of the conference being organized. The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for the Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country. The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country.
Iran's retaliatory strike
against an informal Israeli base in Iraq, which was in response to an act of Israeli aggression in Syria, which resulted in the deaths of two members of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, serves as another stark reminder to Israel's ruling elite, namely that Iran has the intent and the capability to effectively respond to acts of Israeli aggression, either against Iran directly, or against Iranian interests in the Middle East, or against Iran's allies in the Middle East, such as Syria. And I am of the opinion that the Iranian retaliatory strike against the unofficial Israeli base in Iraq will not be lost on the Israeli ruling elite.
Syria and the Israeli regime are technically at war due to the latter's 1967 occupation of the Arab country's Golan Heights. The Israeli regime maintains a significant military presence in the territory, which it uses as a launchpad for its attacks on the Syrian soil. Israel has attacked Syria repeatedly through the past years. The reasons it provides fall short of being enough to justify the death and destruction that it has caused. Tel Aviv has been a key supporter of terrorist groups fighting to topple the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad since March 2011. The regime has also been providing safe passage and medical treatment to the Takfiri terrorists who flee the Allies' defensive operations. Israel's recent attack on the Syrian capital led to the martyrdom of two Iranian military advisors with the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The elite military force has been providing Syria with military advisory assistance in the face of foreign-sponsored militancy.
Iran has developed a very strong and a very robust armed forces which can meet Israeli aggression. Nonetheless, the Israelis, because of the unconditional support they receive year on year from Washington, will continue to act in the most criminal way possible.
Israel violates international law as well as international humanitarian law and refuses to implement dozens of resolutions or abide by recommendations put forward by relevant United Nations committees. Isn't it time the UN or other world countries gave this the attention that it deserves before the situation spirals out of control? The UN Security Council meeting turned into a heated argument between Moscow and Washington. The US and Russian delegates exchanged accusations over alleged biological weapons in Ukraine. The Russian envoy warned the European countries of the danger posed by Ukraine's research into biological weapons. Russia says the US-funded biolabs have researched spreading the highly infectious bird flu virus through migratory birds and pathogens such as bacteria and viruses that can be transmitted from bats to humans. The US, however, rejected Russia's allegation of biological activities, claiming that biological laboratories in Ukraine have nothing to do with chemical arms. It also interpreted the accusation as a sign that Moscow plans to use chemical or biological weapons in Ukraine. Washington initially condemned Russia for spreading disinformation. Nevertheless, after Russia published documents showing that Kyiv was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon, U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland admitted the existence of U.S.-funded biological research facilities in the country, saying Washington is working with Kyiv to prevent Russia from getting the research materials. The contradictory remarks further deepen the world's doubts about the US. Why is the US hastily attempting to destroy the materials? Is it trying to hide something?
Well, first of all, the United States specializes in moving its chemical and biological weapons activities away from its own territory to allow itself a degree of deniability. In other words, we didn't do that. It was a private venture of an academic institute or of a government department not related to the militaries.
The United States has spent more than $200 million on the work of biological laboratories in Ukraine. It has 30 biological laboratories and other related facilities in the country which are possibly involved in the production of bioweapons. And these are less than 10% of the 336 biological laboratories the U.S. reportedly controls in 30 countries around the world. Deputy Chairman of the Council of Ministers of Crimea, Georgi Muradov, says the United States had plans to open a biolab on the peninsula before its annexation to Russia. He also accused the Pentagon of developing biological weapons in its secret laboratories on the Ukrainian territory. Also, China has called on the United States to release all-around details of its biological laboratories in Ukraine and urged relevant parties to ensure their safety. The U.S. has blocked the building of the Biological Weapons Convention Verification Protocol for 2 decades and refused to accept inspections of biological facilities within and outside its borders, despite having over 300 biological laboratories all over the world. It seems that by doing so, the U.S. wants to protect the secrets of its biological labs worldwide. It's reasonable and legitimate for the international community to question the U.S. for that, especially since it has a history of using chemical weapons. The U.S. dropped massive quantities of white phosphorus on the Iraqi city of Fallujah during an attack on the city in November 2004, killing insurgents and civilians with the appalling burns that are the signature of this weapon. Also, 5 decades after the Vietnam War ended, Agent Orange continues to impact communities in Vietnam and Laos today. It contained dioxin, one of the most toxic chemicals known to humans. It is linked to increased rates of cancers and birth defects. Vietnam says several million people have been affected by Agent Orange, including 150,000 children born with severe birth defects.
Well, the United States has always managed to present two faces to the world. One is the face of the American democracy attempting to achieve peace according to their propaganda, and the other is the military-industrial complex that runs the American economy by making wars. So the political element of the U.S. system denies involvement in such activities, while behind the back of the public, even the American public, is deceived in order to keep the regime popular at home. But behind the back of the American public, the United States is more involved than any other country in the world in these areas.
Biological weapons are seen as weapons of mass destruction together with nuclear and chemical weapons. Any suspicion of biological weapons must be promptly investigated. Therefore, the U.S. owes the world an answer on what it has been up to in its so-called biological research facilities in Ukraine.
September 11, 2001. The United States is hit by 4 coordinated terrorist attacks, the first major assault on the U.S. soil since World War II. Nearly 3,000 people are killed and some 20,000 others injured. The U.S. responds with an all-out war on Afghanistan, where the terror group Al-Qaeda that planned and carried out the attack was said to be based. Fast forward 20 years. U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order in September giving the Justice Department a 6-month notice to release the documents on the FBI's investigations into the incident. Yet on Thursday, the department acknowledged that it would miss the deadline, suggesting that they would be released by mid-April. It says the delay is due to continuing coordination with a number of foreign governments and ongoing interagency review. One of the governments in question is likely to be Saudi Arabia. Out of 19 terrorists involved in the attacks, 15 were Saudi nationals. the close ties between Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Saudi royal family also raised questions that Saudi Arabian authorities supported the operation. Some observers believe the conflict in Ukraine and the West's sweeping sanctions on Russia, especially its energy sector, which has sent fuel prices skyrocketing around the world, could explain the delay in the release of the documents, as the United States needs Saudi Arabia, with the world's second largest oil reserves, to fill in the gap.
And obviously there's a quid pro quo going on here. How serious it's going to be is another question. You still got, hanging over all of this, the fact that Vice President Cheney at the time, in 9/11, arranged for all these Saudis to leave the country, leave the United States and go back to Saudi Arabia. So there was no follow-up at the time, contemporaneously, with the Saudi presence in the United States, or the fact that most of the people who were involved in the actual hijackings of these planes were Saudis. So clearly, there is something here that is extremely troubling. And clearly, the Saudis do not want this out. And I suspect there are large sections of the United States government who are not interested in having a serious discussion about this.
But the delay isn't good news to thousands of families who are seeking justice for the loved ones they lost on 9/11. Soon after taking office, Joe Biden said the U.S. was ending all its support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen, proclaiming that the war has to end. But, back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden, with the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he staked much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States.
It's unlikely that people are going to support the United States in the hour of need without some concessions. I mean, I just don't see it. It's possible, I suppose. Maybe there's some threats or whatever, but it's unlikely. And the Saudis have been very clear in the paper today. They said they want more support by the United States for their adventure in Yemen, among other things. There was a list.
The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. But will it forgive possible perpetrators of attacks on its own citizens too? What message would that have for the attackers? Wouldn't that embolden them to commit even worse crimes, knowing that it can get away with murder in its most literal sense?
As the war between Russia and Ukraine drags on, there are indications that Ukraine has hosted US-funded labs to develop biological weapons. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland has admitted that Ukraine hosts biological research facilities.
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces.
So that Victoria Nuland, the guru of the Maidan, who was passing out cookies to the fascist Azov battalion in 2014 during the coup against the legitimate government, was forced to admit that these facilities were there. She didn't clarify what they were exactly, but she indicated that they were dismantled quickly in order to prevent them from falling into the hands of the Russians.
The admission came after Russia published documents showing that Kiev was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon. The dangerous pathogens across Ukrainian biolab facilities included anthrax, the plague, tularemia, cholera, and other deadly diseases. In the past several days, long-standing fears, which we have expressed repeatedly for years, regarding the development of military biological materials by the United States on the territory of Ukraine under the auspices of the relevant U.S. Special Services, have been confirmed. Earlier, the Russian Defense Ministry said it had found evidence of U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine, which had urgently destroyed samples of deadly pathogens when the military offensive started.
I think the United States was caught by surprise now. At first, they've been denying all the accusations that are being made, you know, over the past few months that they're conducting biological warfare research. You had this incident here, which initially they really couldn't deny.
Russia says U.S. statements about Ukraine's biolabs indicate fears by Washington that the pathogens stored there may fall into the hands of Russian experts. Moscow says they confirmed the U.S.'s violation of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention.
So either through surrogate or directly, the United States seems to have been involved in creating a capability that would give a country, an allied country, or the United States, a possibility to conduct biological warfare. And that, of course, is forbidden by a variety of UN conventions.
Russia says it had been closely monitoring the bioweapons programs that were developed by the Pentagon in post-Soviet countries. Russia has accused the U.S. of working in Ukraine since 2005 and being involved in the construction, modernization, and operation of over a dozen biolabs suitable for storing or working with pathogens, including those used in bioweapons.
The fact that they existed in Ukraine, where there was a almost obsessive concern and hatred, I must say, among some of the leading factions, right-wing factions in the Ukrainian government against Russia, that they, I think, would be quite prepared to use them in a war with someone they considered their deadly foe. And if they did so, it was with the full backing of the United States, who set up these facilities in the first place.
Moscow has expressed deep concerns about these facilities in recent years. Moscow says facilities in Ukraine were developing components for biological weapons, noting that in the near future, the ministry would release its analysis of the received documents. Russia also accuses the U.S. of sponsoring biological labs across a number of former Soviet republics, including Kazakhstan, Armenia, Tajikistan, and Georgia.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Now, it is interesting to know that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the testamentary trustee and he was the seventh divinely appointed successor, vice regent, imam of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the testamentary trustee and the only successor of the sixth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. It is interesting, but we find in the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam that he went through great ordeals, difficulties, trials, tribulations, troublesome afflictions, and it was not limited to these. Matter of fact, Imam al-Kazim was held hostage in prisons. He was put through pain and torture, and it can be said that he was very much like the Messiah, Isa ibn Maryam, in his devotions, his piety, and his asceticism. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام جهاد المرأة حسن التبعل.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated,
The jihad of a woman is to be of excellent service to her husband.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, in the beautiful conversations and dialogues of this divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, peace be upon him, we find that on many occasions he advised his companions to cling to patience, to hold on firmly to patience, and especially so when they are faced with a disaster or a misfortune. Now, if we explain this before we talk about what Imam al-Kadhim said, we find that impatience takes away the reward Allah has prepared for the patient. And we find in the Holy Quran, in many places, of course, that Allah is with the patient, and Allah considers the patient to be victorious and to be prosperous and successful. And so from the other traditions that we have and in these other conversations of the divinely appointed imams, we find that they give us a whole host and variety and kinds of reasons to be patient. Here, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, "One is not worthy of the reward of a misfortune except through patience," and saying, "We belong to Allah, and to Allah is our return." Here, dear friends, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam is talking about the verse of the Holy Quran, the word of Allah, where the Almighty Allah says, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un." We belong to Allah, and to Allah is our return. So this is one of the things that we say during misfortune. And if we remain patient during misfortunes and trials and tribulations and disasters, not only will we succeed and overcome the said disaster and misfortune, but through the patience, we will also gain a great reward. It is interesting, but this statement of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam directly reminds me of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the third divinely appointed Imam. For when the trials and tribulations and misfortunes and calamities had reached a peak, we hear that it was Imam al-Hussein who said, "We belong to Allah, and to Allah is our return." This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
There are a number and a countless narratives from the life of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi, in the idea that the religion of Islam is not a religion of individualism. It's not a religion of monasticism. It's not a religion that practices or advocates celibacy, whereby an individual lives like a hermit and isolates themselves. The religion of Islam encourages community service, social activeness. The religion of Islam, when it comes to the Holy Quran, over 200 verses, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks to the community. You and I, when we speak to Allah, we speak in the plural sense. We say, إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ وَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ. And when we say the tashahhud, السلام علينا.